Welcome to this brand new episode of the Marketing Technology Podcast. This podcast is hosted by Mark van Horek and myself, Elias Krum. We're both from Marketing Guys, a MarTech agency based out of the Netherlands. Welcome to this new episode of the Marketing Technology Podcast. Today we have Oren Greenberg, based out of London in the UK. And Oren is an on-demand chief marketing officer for his company Curve. Welcome, Oren.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Oren, first to start off with this, what's an on-demand CMO? What do you do in daily life?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I effectively work in three capacities. The first is an advisor, so I'm an exec for a few different businesses. One of them is actually a new advisory role in some MarTech platform in the UK, and a few other different, varied different types of businesses that aren't only in MarTech. And the second is I work on a project basis as a strategic project lead, so you know, a bit more tactical. And then the third is a sort of hybrid of an agency and consultancy model. And effectively what I found is, I think the way people are buying is shifting, and people have project-based needs, and they have more, they need access to experience and knowledge, but they don't always want to have to commit to long-term contracts or full-time employment. They want to have a variety of different cognitive abilities and experiences around the table. And I think this is happening in the B2C front, you know, this kind of access to, fractional access to individuals. If it's people who are coming and fixing your IKEA table through TaskRabbit, or if it's a, you know, an Uber driver who just does a few hours a day, and you know, rather than a full-time taxi driver. So that, and I think that B2C mindset and flexibility, that, because people want more flexible lifestyles, is starting to permeate in the current B2B. So in the UK, I think it's a bit ahead of its time, and in Europe, but in the US, there is quite a lot of popularity around the fractional CMO model. And then the third one, you know, where it's like an agency hybrid, you know, it's great doing strategy work and it's great doing advisory, but there's always a gap in between the architectural plan and the builders and the painters who do the work. And I find that if you can get the person who formulated the strategy to be involved with the tactical delivery rather than just handing it off, then you're more likely to get a better result. So what I found is I need to get involved on a tactical level as well to execute according to the vision and the strategy, rather than have separation between strategy and tactical. And I think that's where the gap is. I think there's a gap in general in understanding the deep thinking and the specialized knowledge that's required on a strategic level and the tactical specialist execution. And the reality is, as a CMO, you know, no CMO that I know is working on Facebook day in, day out on a channel. And Facebook's quite a deep channel in terms of paid social. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how does a CMO leverage and get a good result on Facebook? It's they have to find that specialist provider, vendor. And, you know, I'm seeing a lot of shift from agencies to in-housing as well. So I think a lot of them, especially on the bigger brands, they want to have more control, they want to reduce costs, and they want to, you know, by reducing the margin that the agency takes, they're managing to capitalize on the investment and they have more control over the brand. And, you know, there's also part of this trend where you see businesses starting to become content producers. So a lot of brands are now owning content brands like Red Bull, or actually starting to produce big content marketing teams in-house to try and build and establish their brand. Mm-hmm. So there's like this whole general shift that I'm seeing, and my positioning around the on-demand CMO is access on a fractional basis. Sometimes it's part-time, sometimes it's interim, sometimes it's advisory, sometimes it's project basis. So it's just, it's an interesting exploration. And general feedback recently is that it's a bit ahead of its time. So it's still in experimental phases.
Okay, so good to hear that. But I think we had like an on-demand CMO about 1.5 year back from the US on the podcast as well, acting more like an interim CMO. But what you're explaining here is that you're also combining it in new ways of, let's say, business models, etc. Because the thing that also intrigued me when I'm looking on your LinkedIn profile, which of course I'll put in the show notes, is that besides being an on-demand CMO, you're also an advisory and an advocate to specifically startups. Is that correct?
Yeah, so a lot of my background, you know, I've been doing marketing for about 17 years now, and I've worked in, I think, 4 or 5 VC-backed businesses in-house, and then I started an agency back in 2013, and because, I guess, of my network, I get a lot of referral for startups seeking my advice or support. So I have a really interesting mix where, you know, on one hand, I'm doing work for corporates like Investec Bank, Canon, Lenovo, and HomeServe. And on the other hand, I've worked in any given year with probably 3 to 5 of the startups that I mentioned in the top 100 fastest growing startups in the UK. And I've gone through quite a few. I've probably worked with about 35, 40 startups in the last 10 years in different capacities. So I kind of straddle the speed and the agility that startups have and the kind of the passion and the deep thinking with what the corporates want when they want more flexibility, they want more agility, and they want more speed because they have more processes, they have a lot more complexity because they have a lot of internal stakeholders with constant change, and they have a much more complicated process for buying because the buying committee is a lot larger. There's a lot more, there's like, you know, some instances I've been involved, there's like 18 different people involved with a purchase. Yep. And the truth is, when you have a committee that large, you're never going to have consensus. So when a committee gets to a certain size, it's almost never going to happen that a sale occurs. Or if it does, it can take like years and years and drag out. And I think this really happens in MarTech on the deepest layer of infrastructure. You know, so the systems that touch upon the most amount of different stakeholders in the business are at the most threat to stall or not actually move at the pace or need the business has, but they also can have the biggest impact on the business because they're so deep and deeply integrated. And, you know, I see this a few across a few different corporate sizes and businesses where there's complexity due to one of the businesses, they had 13 different CRM systems. And instead of one centralized CRM, you had 13, and they weren't integrated. So it was very fragmented, and it was practically impossible to create an omni-channel experience or not even that. I think there's one thing about the omni-channel experience, but there's this whole deep, incredible insight and real results that can be driven from predictive AI. And that needs a lot of data, and you need to be pulling in as many data sources as possible. And if they're siloed, you're going to be really blocked in trying to leverage this incredible technology. And I'm always blown away when I see like predictive scores, and you know the and then you put that into practice, and you see, wow, actually the predictive score is accurate in how I should shift my marketing budget on the different channels, and you know, reduce my CPA and increase my ROI. And I have no idea how the black box did it. And it always blows my mind. You know, the I guess how accurately statistics are able to effectively measure reality or tap into reality, you know, because a lot of the time we have models in our minds of how things should work. And then, you know, we go and we do it and we fail. And, you know, I don't know about everyone listening, but I fail a lot. I try a lot of different things and I just happen to fail a lot. So my goal isn't to fail, but I do believe that my failure rate and increasing my failure rate increases my probability of discovery.
Absolutely.
And experimentation. And I think that's really what innovation is. I think innovation is an attitude, an appetite towards risk, and an acceptance that a high failure rate is indicative of either, you know, just doing a lot of the wrong things and not learning, just doing a lot of things and learning. I guess it depends on what your win to loss ratio is.
Absolutely. So, and that's absolutely fascinating to see how you've created, let's say, the dream job for yourself, being able to, let's say, test new stuff at the lean, fast, smaller startups, where you actually have that, let's say, innovation, etc., going on. And on the other hand, you're working with the bigger brands, like you mentioned, like Canon and Lenovo, who actually have the budgets to try that stuff. So you must be a happy person in MarTech to be able to have best of both worlds, actually.
Yeah, I don't want to depict a idealistic picture here, because I think it induces a huge amount of effort, and you know, it's very challenging because you need to advocate a vision and get a budget, and the getting budget is never easy in any business, mm-hmm. to justify an experimental approach. And the truth is, it really takes a type of a visionary. And the truth is, it's you got to find that chemistry set. It's like, I got to find that right person to work with who understands startup mentality. And the people I tend to work with who are in the corporates, actually, they have a very interesting experience in the different corporate organization where they're actually the black sheep. They're different because they're really, you know, the early adopters, and they're really opportunity focused. They don't look at risk in the same way. And it's those people that I gel well with, and we're able to do cool, interesting new things that just deliver results exponentially faster than the traditional approach. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the problem with corporates is they progressively breed a mentality of risk aversion because of the, you know, the nature of being publicly listed, the nature of, sensitivity around social and PR and horror stories. And, you know, a lot of people, when they've worked for 20, 30 years to build up their career, they haven't gone in there because they've taken unnecessary risk. So there's a lot of, you know, challenging the attitude towards risk. And it's very much about finding the right person who has the right mindset, mm-hmm. and can advocate that. But in reality, it tends to work better when you're working with someone who already has a successful P&L, whose core business is already proven, who already has tenure and is looking to increase the growth rate. You know, so it's like the foundational business is functioning. And one of the businesses I was involved with recently, their core business took a big hit and the appetite for innovation plummeted because obviously, you know, if they don't have the core income, you know, going and you know, gambling your money when you can't even pay the rent is quite, it's nonsensical. Yeah. So absolutely. In reality, I think it's a rich man's, it's a rich man's prerogative. And, but I think it's like diversified investing on a personal sense as well. You know, you have to take higher risk, but if you take high risk over long term, you'll get better return. The problem is people take a high risk, but they have a short-term mentality. So it's like, what, 3 months in and we don't have results? Okay, we're cutting this project. It's like, we haven't even started yet. I think it's just the time is the issue. It's the time alignment to KPIs, and mm-hmm. you need a lot of experience to understand how long it takes.
Okay. So you already briefly brought up the MarTech landscape. The MarTech landscape is a visual that is being published by Chief MarTech, Scott Brinker at Chief MarTech on an annual basis. I think he started doing that back in 2011, having about 300 technologies on there in 2011. And currently there are over 7,000 or 8,000 in there in the MarTech landscape. And you have actually done some research and you have actually visualized data on that, which we're going to share in the show notes, by the way. So we're going to put a link in the show notes to your website with the results, and people can sign up there. But could you share a little about what you did? Because for the impression I have here is that it's actually putting more value in what we see in the MarTech landscape at the moment. Because what we look at is a lot of logos, but there is not like a qualification or a measurement done in there. So it seems like every logo is equal, but in practice, a lot of technologies are way more sensitive to, let's say, the market than others. And you have actually found a way to add value and visualize that. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. So what I was very curious, you know, I'm really a big fan of Scott's work, and I was having a chat with him the other day, and I was thinking, you know, it'd be really great to see which categories are growing and which are shrinking, but also who are the best contenders in each category. And there's 50 subcategories, there's 7,100 unique websites. And I was very curious, like, you know, how much traffic do the big ones get? And I had specific questions. Like, for example, in the category, if you had a business that is very, very large, like a monopoly, and it has, let's say, 40 to 60% market share, and it's growing at a certain rate or it has a certain size, does that stifle or limit the growth of the small or medium-sized businesses in that category? So these are some of the questions I wanted to investigate. I wanted to understand, are there more growing or shrinking websites in a certain category if the category in aggregate is shrinking or growing? So is the whole category going up, or is there some sort of shift where one of the bigger players is going up or going down, and that's why the category is shifting? Mm-hmm. And I was also very interested in, you know, what is the concentration of the different businesses in each one of the categories? So these are all the different questions I had. And what I decided to do was, I have a relationship with SimilarWeb, and they, from my experience, have used eight different tools in that same space, and they are the most accurate. They provide the most accurate representation of both the traffic that different websites get, but also the mix of where they're getting their traffic on digital channels. So what we did is we enriched all of the 7,100 websites for the period of the last 3 years, and we started to plot all of these different websites visually to understand which categories are growing the fastest. So for instance, the category of collaboration is the fastest growing out of all the 50 categories in the last 3 years. And interestingly enough, it's been accelerated through the COVID. And you can see the growth rate during COVID has accelerated the growth in that category higher than some of the others. But some other categories that I was really surprised about was, for example, around governance, compliance, and privacy, which is a really niche and a very small category in terms of the number of websites in that sector. But it's one of the fastest growing. And it's not surprising with GDPR and COPPA and other compliancy and privacy issues and, mm-hmm. you know, Google and their cookie privacy policy and browsers. So now there's this opportunity. And another really interesting category was CDPs. You know, a few years ago, like no one even knew what a customer data platform was. Now there's around 95 CDPs in the market. And that's a very small category in terms of the total traffic it receives, but its growth rate is quite impressive. So what I've been trying to do is understand some of that data. And what I've also done is I've created tables for each category to show who are the top fastest growing, the ones who are stagnant, and the ones who are shrinking. And I think it's very interesting for someone in their own subcategory to check out the other websites and see how they compare in terms of their total traffic and the other top categories, you know, the other top websites in their category, and also other categories and how they compare in terms of the total category they're operating in. And so I think there's a really interesting insight there for different businesses to delve in and understand the MarTech landscape and how it's moving and shifting over time.
Absolutely. So it gave me a lot of insight because I've already had that access to some of the charts that you are describing. And yes, we for example also saw that innovations that came out back in 2015, for example, like account-based marketing, actually are on the let's say smaller growth percentage than, for example, sales enablement, which is pretty hot at the moment. So I think ABM or account-based marketing was the slowest growing technology on one of your sheets. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I mean, ABM only grew from about 270,000 uniques to about 607,000 uniques. So a bit more than like double growth. And that's actually relatively small. So if we look at collaboration, it grew from 650 million to 2.5 billion, which is almost a 4 or 5x fold growth rate. So there's two aspects to this. There's a total traffic.
Yep.
Now, it's obviously websites or categories that have a disproportionate large amount of traffic are likely to have a faster growth rate because as a proportion, you know, they have more exposure, so it's easier for them. But that's not always the case, which is quite interesting. I think what shocked me the most is of the 7,100, the top 30 or top 50, I can't remember off the top of my head, accounted for 80% of the traffic. And I knew... And this really messes up Pareto's law of 80-20. You know, this is a very, very small amount of websites commanding a disproportionately huge amount of the volume. And I think these monopolies are, it's very problematic, you know, because it's like they command so much real estate and they command such volume that it doesn't create a competitive landscape that benefits the consumer, because they're too monopolized. And I think, you know, Google, Facebook, Yahoo, and those players in that space, you know, these very large brands, it's problematic, I think, from you know, in terms of humanity as a whole, and, you know, making sure that humanity is innovating and providing value to businesses and consumers. And for me, that skew was really surprising. I expected a skew. I just didn't think it was going to be that severe. So there's some really interesting pieces of insight. But yeah, for anyone who's listening, who's interested, just hit the link and sign up on the waiting list. And when I release it into the wild, you'll be the first to know.
Absolutely. So, and we're gonna put a link in the show notes to your website where people actually can sign up to get the results to your findings, because I really think this is a lot of value that's being added by you, and gives real insights. Because, as said, you know, the MarTech landscape on itself is always discussed a lot when it comes out on a yearly basis, but this really gives, let's say, insights into what's important and what's not important, and which directions we're moving into. So that's I found it really an eye opener to see a lot of that stuff happening. So thanks for sharing that, and we're going to put a link in the show notes. Another topic that I would like to talk to you about is marketing channel strategy, because you're an expert in that as well, and specifically on how to test and validate the right channels. So you're doing that for some let's say runners up, smaller companies, trying to help them, because in my perspective, when people are adopting a marketing channel strategy or an online channel strategy, they don't test a lot, they don't validate. They just it's more like a trial and error. What they're doing. Have you found a way or a structured way to help companies define the right marketing channel strategy?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting, an interesting challenge, because I think there's multiple components to getting success in the marketing strategy. And I think the analogy is like a car. And, you know, a car, if you built the whole car, but you forgot the engine, it's kind of interesting. It's like there's so many components to the car, but unless you have the engine, the whole vehicle is useless, right? That you can't actually use any of the other parts unless all of the parts work together. And I don't think marketing strategy is often viewed this way, but I think it's the same. And if your brand positioning and message is not clear and aligned to your audience, if your messaging to that audience is off, if your funnel that you, the journey that you take them on is off, if you're not managing to curate the data correctly, and, you know, analyze it, if, you know, your pricing is off, and the way that you're, you know, selling data with the wrong, you know, selling products with the wrong margin because your data is erroneous, then you actually potentially, I've seen this happen where the business is actually losing money, not making it because of an accounting error, because the margin calculated the whole product SKUs of 2000
really?
Products is off. Yeah. So it's very interesting to see how it has multiple components to getting the marketing strategy right. But one of the key components that people kind of jump to and is obviously very pertinent is, you know, we need distribution, right? You know, you have to get traffic to get leads, marketing qualified leads, sales qualified leads, sales accepted leads, and then, you know, get the pipeline humming on the B2B front, on the B2C, if it's e-commerce, you know, basket sizes and sales, you need to get the traffic and relevant consumers to engage with the products in order to drive revenue. Now, because there's so many different channels, the question is, you know, where can I get the most amount of relevant traffic for the cheapest possible cost? That's effectively the basic, the foundation of the formula for success. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is, unless you have a lot of experience in that industry or that space, or you've done it before and you're attacking a very similar niche and you're very familiar with it, the answer is most businesses, a lot of businesses, they don't know. They don't know where the growth is going to come from. One example I came across the other day was, and this business is quite a fast B2C business in the UK, fast growing. And they did two ads in two magazines that are very similar. And one of them had a 4x increase on lead gen, even though they're very similar magazines. And they're both like health-related magazines. And it's a very interesting idea where if I was to say beforehand, which magazine is going to get us a 4x increase, no one would know. You just didn't know which magazine was going to perform. So there's this problem where I think a lot of stakeholders, they already have the answers before, you know, they have the question and they already have the answer, but the answer is, it goes back to what I was saying about the mental model. The mental model in their head is erroneous. So they have an idea that's not aligned to reality. So our approach is, well, just validate by testing in the channels as quickly as possible to double down on your learning. And effectively, the more data you have, the more accurately you can calibrate your expectation. So what does that tangibly look like? So it actually varies from channel to channel. For example, we had a client the other day, and they wanted to do Google Ads. And I was saying, well, why? Well, they're like, well, it's a major channel. And I said, but why Google Ads? And they said, well, because it's a major channel. And we kind of got stuck in a loop. And I said, well, have you done any research or any work on Google Ads to try and validate it? And they said, no. And I said, well, why don't we do that before you commit all this resource and time and money to a 6-month contract with this agency to go with a channel that may not actually perform? And then they realized they had made a leap of faith into thinking they're going to get performance without thinking, well, can't we just do the keyword research piece, run a campaign for a few £1,000 over a period of a week or two, just to see if we get any leads before committing to a 6-month contract to attack that channel. Now, The tension there is, what if there was calibration required to actually crack that channel? So we had an instance where we had a business that I was supporting, and they had a provider who was helping on Google Ads, and they were at it for quite a while, and it took them 4 months until they cracked it. Why? They just shifted the targeting to affluent areas, and that managed to crack it because the value of the product was quite high margin and quite expensive, and therefore they were able to shift it into a more affluent category of consumer who was going to purchase. And there's kind of two conflicting things here. One of them is, how much time do you give a channel until you get enough data before you pull the plug, and how much do you spend and waste on that? And I think that the key here is actually, well, it's much easier if you can benchmark across channels, because if one channel is giving you a cost per lead of £600 and another channel is getting you a cost per lead of £60, why are you sustaining the experiment on the second channel of 600 if you can just double down and keep growing on the one that's £60, because that's a more effective channel? And the problem is, people don't diversify across enough channels, and they go too deep in terms of their commitment and their approach. And I think it's the vendors who are to blame for this. So the supplier, a CMO or marketing director or head of growth, they I see how they go through the vendor selection process, and they say, this is our challenge. And the vendor says, you should be doing this. And you go, why should we be doing that? And then, because this is how you're going to get a result. But what actually happens is, a lot of the vendors, the agencies and the freelancers, they're conditioned through their own experience. If you talk to any marketeer, there's like 16 different types of marketeers, right? The programmatic, the paid social, the paid search, the content marketeer, the PR and comms, etc. And each one of them tends to specialize. Maybe one will breach into one or two. Someone that does SEO tends to do a bit of PPC, and some things go together, or PPC goes with paid social. But you very rarely find someone who's a coder, who knows SQL, who does paid social, who does comms, and does like technical SEO. It's just like, it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, the people believe in the channel they have experience with. But from a holistic point of view, as a CMO, when you look at the channel mix, that isn't necessarily the right channel to go for. And what happens is, the vendor tends to take the supplier tends to take the client on some sort of rodeo down a path that isn't necessarily the right path. And what I tend to do as a kind of impartial advisor is, I tend to kind of sense check the validation process. And we still end up going with the top channels we think are going to perform, but instead of just going with one and committing to 6 months, we just go, it's much more rapid. So it's much faster experimentation in terms of a creative deployment. And you really need a developer on the team, you need a designer on the team, you need a copy person on the team, and then you need your performance marketeer to be driving this. And then you just need to be driving rapid experimentation.
And when you're running a test, sorry to interrupt you, but I'm just curious to hear, because I have a couple of questions raising up when you're telling me. Yeah, I'm getting enthusiastic about it. Because when you're validating or testing, what kind of typical KPIs? You already mentioned cost per lead, for example, but are there typical KPIs that you're looking to validate or to find the best results on? Or
yes. So I always use baseline benchmarks when I take on a new project, and I just assume that they need to hit the average or slightly below, slightly above average. And this is end-to-end conversion rate funnels. So for example, Salesforce, which I think is probably the most credible source in the world for end-to-end B2B funnel conversion rate, because they have the most amount of data in the world on this topic. they released data that showed a 0.2%. So I think from traffic, from visit, all the way to deal one, 0.2% is a benchmark. Now, I've personally seen it go all the way up to 2.5%. So for me, anywhere between 0.2% to 2.5% is sensical. But I see a lot of companies, I had a client the other day, they were doing paid social, and they took clients to a blog post, and the cost per lead was £450 cost per lead. And then I changed the destination to it was a SaaS software, to a free trial landing page instead of a blog post, because they didn't have call to actions on the blog post. They're burning a lot of money every month. And we saw the cost per lead drop from £450 to £18.
Wow.
So in a way, if I approach that with what's the benchmark conversion rate, it gives me an indication that, you know, they're very, very far off, because obviously they weren't getting any deal ones of £450 per lead. It was too expensive, and they couldn't sustain the campaign long enough to get enough data to even get deal one to find the conversion rate. But there was, you know, relative to the value of the proposition, it was very clear that they, you know, paying at 23x the value, even optimizing that channel, you're never going to get it from 23x to, you know, a third CAC LTV, cost of customer acquisition to lifetime value ratio that's recommended. And you're never going to achieve that ratio from a 23x to, you know, a 33%. Mm-hmm. So, I think there's, you know, it does vary from B2B to B2C, and it varies in B2C and B2B. You know, I've had B2C clients where the lead value was £500, and I've had B2B where a lead value is £40. And usually it's intuitive, it's the other way around, right? You know, because you work with enterprise B2B, and suddenly a customer is worth £500,000,
yep.
And your cost per lead is, you know, in tens of thousands. And then you suddenly flip to B2C, and it's like, you know, higher value than B2B. And I don't think it's really B2C per B2B. I think it really is, you know, what is a product? What is the audience? What is the margin? What is the funnel? What is the channel mix? What are the resources? It's really like, you know, the more I mature as a marketeer, the more I take a holistic approach, because I think there's systemic problems in a lot of the businesses that I see where they're trying to drive a car with only two wheels, or they're trying to drive a car, but there's no steering wheel. And it's like, it sounds so obvious, you know, when you say, how could you drive a car without a steering wheel? And you go, how did they get into the situation that they're trying to drive a car without a steering wheel? And the answer is, we're very familiar with what a car is. Like, cars have been around for, like, you know, a long time, right? And we've perfected the process of building them. But initially, when you were first trying to build a car for the first time, it's a very messy affair. And but trying to build a new business, especially if it's innovative or not been done, or trying to provide some sort of competitive advantage, is effectively experimenting with building a car for the very first time. It is very messy. And it's that lack of visibility that I think a lot of seasoned practitioners like myself can get very frustrated with a lot of businesses, because it's like so obvious when we see it. A lot of CMOs will relate to this. Why aren't they doing the basics? Like, their message, you know, I see businesses just overcomplicate things. They're trying to appear bigger than they are. So they have convoluted messaging. They have multiple services that are very hard to understand. And in their head, they're doing their best to describe their service offering and solve the problems for their clients. But in reality, they're not simplifying it enough, or they're not going deep enough into understanding the pain that they're solving. They're not articulating that in a coherent way that's relevant for their audience. So there's a lot of components to it where, you know, sometimes the strategy is wrong. It's a completely wrong product for the wrong audience or the wrong channels. Sometimes I see the tactical execution is wrong. And sometimes you can just have a click or a shift in a channel that delivers a massive result. Like I said, with the geo-targeting, suddenly you switch on geo-targeting and suddenly the channel is successful. And so it's like a bit of a tension between figuring it out. I think it is more arts and science. But I think even though it's more art than science, the methodology and approach to the artistic way of thinking needs to be grounded in scientific thinking, which is to say consistent, measured experiments deployed rapidly. And that agile and rapid approach to learning and getting data will help you figure out more effectively than if you're doing it anecdotally or not doing it in an effectively measured or well-planned out way.
So what you're saying here, and I think this is very interesting for our listeners, is that first of all, you need to test the channels. Don't, let's say, assume that a channel that's suggested to you by an agency or an expert or whatsoever is successful, you need to test on all of them. You need to give it some time, set some KPIs, but it's essential to measure results during that validation period, right? So do you have some tools or technology that you use or would advise to listeners that they could use during this test and validation period?
That's a good question. I can't list, because we use over like 26 different pieces of marketing kit. So we're big fans of, and I think that's another complexity with the MarTech landscape is, I talk to people and they say, what's the best for this? And I said, there's no such thing. But the best example is CRM. So what's the best CRM? And I say, which one of the 220 CRMs do you feel is the best? Because, Salesforce, which is very complex and intricate, but like gives you full power, is not the same as Pipedrive, which is suited for a sales team of five people. Like if you have a sales team of 500 and a sales team of five, it's a different piece of kit. So there is no recommended software, because the different levels of complexity in the tech stack and how they integrate is really critical. Like if you're using HubSpot or Marketo or Pardot, here's a great example actually. So if we took Pardot and Salesforce, Pardot doesn't work well with any other CRM. It doesn't have a native integration. It doesn't have to anything other than Salesforce, and it doesn't have a good API. So if you bought Pardot because I said Pardot was the best for testing and validation, but you don't have Salesforce because I said Pardot was the best, but you use,
Pipedrive
or Chrome, the Chrome one, or even something super lightweight like Insightly or something, and you think it's a CRM, but really it's just a plugin, and you kind of go, well, I'm going to plug that into Pardot because, Oren said it's the best, and then it's a complete mess because it just doesn't work. So I'm very hesitant nowadays to recommend tools. And my approach to tooling is actually, I think I was in a session the other day with a bunch of growth leaders that have worked for the most successful VC-backed business in the UK. And on the call, there was pretty much consensus across all of the CMOs that CMOs spend too much money on MarTech, which is probably blasphemous to say on a MarTech podcast. But I think people look at technology to solve problems that are not... Technology doesn't solve everything. It solves a lot of things, and it can really help increase efficiency. But a lot of the challenges that I see in the marketing strategy are not technology related. Some of them are, and some of them are about poor execution on the tooling. But actually, I'd say the most common issues I see when it comes to MarTech is there's poor adoption in-house. Like I see a lot of CRMs, but they're not properly used. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of marketing tech tools, and they're not properly integrated. And I see a lot of them. I think the truth is people buy the tools because they believe the tool will automate or take away a lot of the headache. But actually, setting up the processes for automation is complex. Pardot has 450 reports out of the box, but it doesn't provide you the best report for the question that you have. You have to select of the 450 the best report that you need. And that takes time and effort and energy. And I think that's where a lot of the gaps are, because marketeers are managing multiple internal stakeholders, multiple channels, multiple resources. They don't actually have the time or the energy to become expert on all the channels, on all the tools, and catch up on all the changes that are happening in the industry, catch up on, the changes in the legal landscape as well, the GDPR, et cetera, still maintain the professional network with contacts that they have. It's very fragmented. It's quite a complicated role, I think, the marketing role. I think there's a reason that the average tenure for the CMO is the shortest in the C-suite. I think because it's a role that's so reliant holistically on so many other parts of the business. A CMO is not going to get a good result with a poor product. And I see a lot of CMOs very frustrated because they are under a lot of scrutiny and pressure to deliver results when actually the product that they have is not the best in the category that they operate in. It's like the fourth or the fifth down. And unfortunately, like with Google, the top result on Google gets 16% of the total share of traffic, the organic top results. Mm-hmm. By the time you're on the top of the second page, you're on 0.2% of total traffic. So it's a massive difference being the best in a category than just being an average Joe. So I think there's a lot of complexity with why selecting the right marketing kit and how to approach the experiment and methodology needs to be tailored and bespoke. And I'm very wary nowadays of making recommendations. Now, that's not to say I don't have my favorite tools. I do have tools that I use frequently, but I use them because I'm very familiar with them. But the truth is, some of them don't work for different clients, and then I have to choose different tools because they don't natively integrate with the tool the client has. And, you know, so even with them, I'm still reluctant to recommend or suggest.
Okay. But,
you
know, if
any listener has a specific Martech question, a specific piece of kit they wanted to compare or they wanted an opinion, feel free to drop me a line and I'll let you know my thoughts. But I need context to be able to provide a lucid answer.
And it also comes back to that analogy with the car that you made, of course. So a lot of CMOs spend a lot of money on MarTech. Actually, the CMO spend survey by Gartner came out, I think, this month for 2020, and it again points out that like 26% of the whole marketing budget that CMO spend is spent on MarTech. That's even a couple of percentages more than they actually spent on people in their marketing team, so on actual personnel. And it's growing again. But you know that analogy of the car. A lot of them buy a car and don't even have a driver's license and expect the car to bring them from A to B automatically or something. Well, unless you have a self-driving Tesla at the moment, that's not going to happen. But I'm completely with you. You know, it's a tailor-made fit that you have to have if you're talking about a MarTech stack, because it really depends on so many aspects of your own, let's say, current situation you have, like the own stack that you have at the moment and the landscape that you of tools that you're using. But of course, also on the whole, let's say, customer journey and which industry you are. How the customer journey is let's say evolving over time, etc., and that asks for different tools. So there's not like a standard set of answers of tools. So I would like to thank you very much for being on the Marketing Technology Podcast. Is there anything you would like to share with the listeners before we conclude this session? All right.
Yeah, just on the MarTech landscape analysis, I have a couple of other projects that I'm working on. So one more is I'm analyzing skills. So I'm looking at the job titles and skills across the mm-hmm. marketing landscape. So classification of the competencies. And part of that is part of a competence assessment platform that I'm building. Mm-hmm. And another project is I'm building a tool that analyzes trends in marketing. So like Google Trends does, instead of you inputting something into Google Trends, it will proactively tell you what the trends are happening in the top most popular 100 blogs in the world, marketing blogs. So there's a few other projects that I'm working on. So if those are of interest to the listeners and they'd like to receive updates or have access to the data from these different projects, then I'll send that update when they sign up for the MarTech landscape on the landing page in the podcast notes.
Yep, I'll put those in the notes. And again, feel free to leave your email address there if you want to receive Oren's updates. Well, thanks again, Oren. It was a pleasure having you on the Marketing Technology Podcast. Thank you very much.
A real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Marketing Technology Podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform or iTunes. Also, if you want to be a guest or know someone that should be a guest to our show, shoot me an email on e.crum@marketingguys.nl. Thank you for listening.